Hello, welcome to the RTE Sport Olympics podcast, episode one for the next fortnight or so. I, Mikey Stafford, will be here with you every evening to give you a bite-sized summation of the day that was and look ahead to the next day with a healthy Irish flavour. I am joined today to look ahead to the opening ceremony, life in the village, what it's like to be an athlete ahead of the games by David Gillick and Jesse Barr. How are you doing, guys?
Hey
All
guys.
right.
Hi.
Yes. So look, there's 32 sports at the Olympics and 329 disciplines. So I've obviously chosen two 400 meter runners to preview the games for me.
It
But
simple.
yeah, exactly. But Jesse, for those of you who don't know, as well as being a former Olympian, is a performance psychologist with the Sport Ireland Institute. And David, as most people know, is a journalist interviewer. With RTE Sport, and he's covering his third games in person, so they know plenty about what goes into an Olympics from a variety of different perspectives. So I think the best place to start probably is the Olympic Village, which I think fascinates those of us who have never been an Olympian, which is obviously the vast majority of people. Jesse, to me, it strikes me as somewhere between college and the Gaeltacht, but with super fit competitive people. Is that about right?
Yeah, I suppose it's probably the closest thing I would compare it to. My one Olympic experience as an athlete was in the London Olympic Village, which probably is quite similar to the Paris experience. I know Rio was a bit messy, a bit hectic, and Tokyo was obviously in lockdown. So there's definitely a feeling of like when you arrive in, well, first of all, by the time you get through all of the security, that's like getting through a very strict airport, it's like a bit of a freshers' week kind of feel. There's uncertainty, excitement in the air, no one knows what to expect, but everyone's there for the same reason. Everyone's really excited, bit of nerves, bit of anticipation. But yeah, it's just a really unique, unusual place. Very hard to describe, Like most of the athletes that are going in are probably adults, but you kind of become quite juvenile when you go in there. You're finding games rooms, you're back to sharing very, very small rooms that have, very basic interior, like a college apartment.
Cardboard beds, of course.
Cardboard beds, infamously, as everyone keeps testing them out. Yeah, just it's a whole, there's this idea of the Olympic Village being this really glamorous, exciting place, and it is, but there's also a lot of mundane monotony to it as well when you kind of get into the day-to-day routine and the novelty of all of the newness wears off. So
Yeah.
yeah, it's a cool place though, I must say.
David, as an athletics and competitor, obviously you were usually there for the post-tournament parties as opposed to the pre-tournament stress and kind of nerves and first day of the Gaeltacht vibes.
Yeah, it's exactly like that, and as Jesse kind of described there as well, it can be quite overwhelming for an awful lot of athletes as well, because generally when you go to a major championship, it's like straight into a hotel. You're very much kind of like focused on your performance. It could be a couple of days prior to the start of your competition, and then the Olympics comes along, and it is very different. It's multi-sport, so straight away there's different shapes and sizes from different events, and you're a little bit kind of, oh, hang on a second, what event did they do? And then suddenly a superstar from the NBA or something like that might rock into the food hall, and suddenly everyone's like, oh my God, there's so and so, and there's all that buzz. And I think that word of just kind of feeling a little bit overwhelmed when you first set foot in it's so big. It's as Jesse said, there's like games rooms, there's suddenly you get word that, oh, there's an event taking place, and they're giving out free mobile phones. So then suddenly Free
everyone's
is the operative. Everyone here is free.
like, I can remember, like in Beijing, we had a little fob that went on accreditation, and anywhere you went, you could just put the fob up to, I think it was like one of these vending machines, and you get free drinks. It's just all a bit like surreal in many ways. And I think, again, from athletic standpoint, we were on the second week, so we kind of came into the village a little bit later, so it was already in full swing by then. You kind of feel, oh, I got to catch up, but what's happening? Where is everything? I got to find my feet, and it can just be a little bit overwhelming. I think that's one of the key elements with a lot of sports people is kind of how they manage that when they go into the village. Like, how do you keep a certain
degree of normality to your process in terms of your competition. You know, you got to learn to do nothing. And that word mundane as well is like, generally you're in that taper phase. So your training's kind of, the quantity is becoming down a little bit. So you suddenly have a little bit more time on your hands, and then you get a bit bored. I'll go down to the food hall. It's open 24/7. It's all free. You know, it's just a bit surreal. So again, it's managing that and trying to, you know, just take it in your stride and just do what you would normally do in terms of a competition.
Yeah, I know McDonald's, I no longer have a deal, so there's that temptation is gone. But I would fear for boxers who have to make weight here, Jesse, you know, fobs, they get you free drinks and the 24/7 food hall. But aside from that risk, I guess you have some athletes who are introverts, some who are extroverts, you know, some who are probably happier to be around competitors and teammates, and some who are probably would prefer something a little bit more isolated.
Yeah, look, every athlete is different. And, you know, it's one of the questions people are always fascinated about from a sports psychology point of view is there, you know, specific types of people who are drawn to their specific types of sports? But actually, everything is so different. Everyone is an individual, and how people are going to respond to the village, it can be kind of hard to predict, especially for athletes who are going into their first village, or if their only other experience was an Olympic village in Tokyo, which is completely different. This is going to be completely open, nothing closed off, and all the full experience. So a lot of the work that we've been doing in the Sport Ireland Institute with the psychology team and life skills team is to try and prepare athletes for all of that, which we can kind of consider noise. You know, it's a lot of noise. There's a lot of distractions, a lot of extra, which is outside of the performance. And, you know, Gavin Noble, the chef de mission, always has some really lovely quotes. And one of the things he said for Tokyo when he was deputy chef was, everything's the same, but everything's different when it comes to the games. And that's really what we're applying here, is that the bits that are the same are the stuff that they're used to. It's the performance, it's the competition arena, it's how they prepare their day-to-day routine, but it's how you manage that in a scenario that is so different. As David said, you're in multi-sport. You know, most athletes will never have experienced being around so many people, like 10,000 athletes in one go from so many different sports, all of the different distractions, which are great distractions in one sense, but then it's also the recognition that, oh, we're really at the Olympic Games. Everywhere you walk, it's the rings, it's Paris 2024. There's just so much to do. So a lot of the work is to try and understand what are the potential distractions that could take away from people's performances, and understanding, you know, if I have a relationship with the athlete, I might have an idea of what are the things that they might find distracting. Some people, it just might be having to stay in those tiny little cardboard beds and a bit of cabin fever setting in, whereas someone else, it could be the overwhelm of the temptation of the food hall, and someone else, it could be just being around a whole Irish team and the feeling a bit of pressure as people are performing and results are starting to roll in. So yeah, you're just constantly trying to mitigate those, but understanding that there is going to be those distractions, and don't, you know, maybe not try to go into completely blinkered, but kind of absorb it as well and see it as all part of the experience.
Yeah. Can it be a help, David, I suppose, because I've got quite into that sprint documentary on Netflix, and you get the idea, you get behind the scenes, obviously, and like, you know, the Diamond League meets where the top athletes kind of race and make their money every year. And like, it's not quite as glamorous as maybe people think. You know, they stay in the same hotels and they eat in the same function rooms. So maybe the Olympics dining hall, that means like it's diluted a bit. You know, you don't have to sit cheek by jowl with your competitor. You can go and, you know, sit one table away from LeBron James and bask in his, you know, fame, or you can sit with your Ireland teammates. And maybe in a way, and I'm sure it's the same for other sports, not just athletics, maybe it's a chance. It is a little bit more relaxed. It's not quite as maybe intense as, and you're not quite as on top of the people you're going to be competing against as you are on at your regular meets.
Yeah, definitely. And if people are kind of wondering, Sprint is on Netflix at the moment, and it's a docu-series very similar to Drive to Survive, Formula One, where, yeah, they've just followed certain athletes around for a season, and it does give a great insight into, I suppose, behind the scenes of what it's like when you travel around and you're on the circuit. So, you know, this is different because it's just the sheer scale of it. It's just so big. And, you know, over 10,000 athletes, the food hall is probably the size of literally, I'd say, Croke Park, you know, the pitch of Croke Park, it's massive. So, you know, again, you probably have more freedom in many ways, because when you're on the athletic circuit, you're very much kind of penned into a hotel and into a room in certain circumstances where you're sitting around your competitors, you're eyeballing them. And, you know, to be honest with you, you're on the circuit with them. So you see them at event after event, hotel after hotel. So this time, yeah, it's a little bit broader, and it probably is that certain degree of freedom. But it goes back to the same kind of principles of like, okay, well, what do you do as an individual prior to a race? Because at the end of the day, you've got to keep it simple. It's another race. And, you know, as Jesse kind of alluded to, it's the noise that can kind of just sometimes get in your head, and suddenly it's different. And, you know, maybe your personality is, when you're around other people, you kind of get maybe carried away with what they're doing, and that can be a bit of a conflict in your own mind. So again, it's kind of stripping that back. Like, I always remember when I was in Beijing, I can remember Usain Bolt coming into the food hall, and probably, look, to be honest, everything kind of is centralized around the food hall. Like, that's the big social area, and when people are bored, or, you know, or what they do, they go down to the food hall. And I can remember Usain Bolt coming in, and he had his people, not an entourage of like 10 people or anything, but he had two or three people that seemed to be with him the whole time, and that was probably his little buffer. So again, in his own mind, these were very important to him, and that's probably something that is very important to certain athletes as they head into like such a massive village where it's brand new. And again, people who maybe were in Tokyo, this will be a little bit different, you know, the COVID Olympics, if you want to call them, where maybe there was less people, whereas now it's back to a normal Olympics where there's all that hustle and bustle going around. And look, it can be a difficult place for a lot of athletes as well, you know, and they would probably make sure they go in at the right time for them. And some people probably like to go in early and be around it all and really soak up the atmosphere. And that could be a key driver in their own performance. Other people might be like, you know what, I can do it without all that mess, and I'm going to go in 24 hours beforehand, you know, and just keep it really simple. But it's weird. I always get the question, like, you know, what's the food like? And, you know, is there many parties? And, you know, what goes on with, you know.
Everyone hears about the hundreds of thousands of condoms that are distributed. Jesus, let's be honest.
And that's the question, like, you know. Yeah. Without being crude, but is there much riding going on in the village? That is always the question I get asked. And it's like,
same.
You know what? Like, it is what it is. That's what people want to know. But like, and look, let's be honest, you know, when competitions, it does get a little bit louder as it goes on. You know, more people are kind of, their Olympics is over. So it's just a time to kind of unwind a little bit. And yeah, they go out and stuff like that. It does get a little bit noisy, but that can be a conflict as well, because athletics is the second week. So you're trying to manage that. Some people are finished on day one, even before, you know, day one, their Olympics is over. So they're in party mode, and all that stuff has to be kind of managed from a team management perspective. And indeed, like, you know, they're all adults. All the athletes are adults. So they have to kind of manage that for their own performances as well.
Yeah. And Jesse, I know Gavin Noble said that Ireland are beside the French, which is good. It means, you know, they've got a prime spot. And he was talking about how the step count will be low because it's not a long walk to the food hall or whatever. And this is all the stuff that's important, isn't it?
Absolutely is. And like this, like the prime real estate in the village is being close to the food hall and the transport. And I think the Irish team are pretty much across from the food hall, which does add a little bit of noise, but it does reduce steps, and similar to the transport, because like when they call it Olympic Village, it very much is a village. So you could be, your step count could go through the roof just by going to and from the food hall three times a day. And it's funny you mentioned step count, like some of the swimmers who wouldn't be big walkers, one of the big things that they're doing to prepare, some of them have said, is adding an extra walk in the day, or actually going for a walk that they wouldn't usually, to just start preparing themselves for being more on their feet than they usually would be at home, because they probably aren't really on their feet at all. So like, some, you know, sometimes the Olympic prep, you think of the really glamorous side, and actually it's like, no, I'm just going for a walk to get used to walking around, which is, you know, it's the kind of, it's the small things you don't think about. But yeah, like there are just so many small things that can be like, you know, we're, as part of the psychology team, we're delivering Paris preparation workshops that started back in Rio. And one slide on that is the idea of, like, it's not the boulder. I can't remember the exact quote, but it's not myself who delivers them, but it's not the rock in your way, but it's the pebble in your shoe, you know, that kind of quote, that like that's the thing that could trip you up. And that's what it is. It is, if you're someone who never walks and suddenly you're to over 10,000 steps a day, that could be the thing that could affect your performance, which is something you'd never think about. So yeah, when it comes to the Olympics, it is managing those extra factors that you just don't have to think about when it comes to the normal major championships.
Yeah, Tour de France, professional cyclists, like, you know, Tour de France cyclists, they're the same. They hate being on their feet. They have a rest day. They're either sitting or they're cycling. Walking is the worst thing they could do, supposedly. David, you've been doing a bit of walking. You've been in Paris for a day. Have you got your head around this opening ceremony, which I think you got to sample Beijing and London, two of the more extravagant opening ceremonies, but I think the French are planning on topping it all, aren't they?
Yeah, it looks that way. Unfortunately, now I never went to my Olympic ceremony. Our holding camp was in Japan in 2008, so I didn't even bring the Olympic suit. That stayed at home because we came into it late. So again, it'd be similar in Paris. Some athletes won't come into the actual village and into central Paris until closer to the event. So the whole kind of thing around the open ceremony, it's very unique. It's a logistical nightmare. You're talking about, like, you know, arguably somewhere between, I don't know, 6,000, 7,000 athletes going down a flotilla of boats going down the Seine. It's quite interesting being here in Paris because there's an awful lot of security. They've brought in the military. I think it's the most military to have been in Paris during peacetime, you know. So again, it's quite focused on security. And I think it's about 5 or 6K along the Seine is all cordoned off. You know, even and like, you know, all the tourists, they can't go to where they want to go because of all these kind of cordons and stuff like that. So it's going to be really interesting, but I think it's quite unique. And maybe from an athlete perspective, it's something, oh, hang on a second, maybe I want to go to that, you know. And this again is another thing thrown in the mix. Oh, this is different. I'm on a boat. Whoa, this could be cool. I don't have to walk as much. Maybe float down. That can add into like reducing steps. These are the things that suddenly become something that's thrown into the pot for an awful lot of athletes. Now, I know on the boat they're talking about, I think there's about 28 seats on the boat. So again, it's not going to be applicable to everybody. Some people will want to go, other people won't. Other people won't simply be in Paris. The whole kind of theme here in Paris is games wide open. And again, it goes back to the whole infrastructure that they're using. There's no central Olympic park as such. They're using established infrastructure, the Stade de France, in various places. So it is very much spread out. And I think this is just kind of going with the theme around bringing it to the people. And the Seine, you know, in Paris is such an integral part of the city. So why not put it on the Seine and float them down? And again, like the flag bearers, we still don't know who the Irish flag bearers are going to
Yeah, they're
be.
keeping us in suspense on that one, aren't they?
Yeah, they
They
are.
do,
Yeah.
yeah.
I don't know. It's probably waiting to see who's
Trying to
available.
figure out who has their sea legs.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. God forbid you get seasick
Oh, God.
on the open ceremony, you know. But all of these things kind of add to it. And I think the general feel I get is that the public are right behind it. It's brilliant. It's bringing it to the people. You can go and you can watch it from, you know, various points. And those who have been to Paris, one of the first things you do is you get a boat tour. So, you know, it's great for the athletes and great to kind of showcase what it's all about. And it will be, like, no doubt it's going to be a spectacular opening ceremony.
Okay, I really hope so. Jesse, just wondering, as an athletics competitor, did you take part in the London opening ceremony?
I absolutely did. It's one of my favorite memories from the games. Because we were competing so late, obviously, as Dave said, like athletics are the second week. I was part of the 4x4 relay, which is the second last day of the entire game. So we had a lot of waiting around to do. So to kind of help us feel like part of the team, we were flown in, or we, I say flown, we got a train from Teddington, where our holding camp was. Got to go to the opening ceremony and stay in the village for, I think, a night, maybe two. No, I think it was just one night. And then we went back to Teddington. So we got a little bit of a flavor of it all. The opening ceremony in London was incredible. I think France are really going to do their absolute damnedest to make sure it's better. But I think the London opening ceremony was incredible. It had very British flavor. You know, you had Rowan Atkinson and Chariots of Fire and all those kind of themes to it. And my experience was, when I was going, I was part of the relay squad, but I wasn't a guarantee that I was going to run. Now, I did end up running. So I kind of saw the opening ceremony as my one opportunity to be to be seen and be visible at the games. So myself and the other one of the other members of the squad, Katrina Cudahy, who ended up not running as part of the relay team, we managed to make our way right to the front of the opening ceremony parade. So in every picture the next morning of the opening ceremony, anyone who was watching it, it was there, it was Katie Taylor holding the flag, you know, doing us proud, and right behind her, myself and Katrina waving to the crowd. So I was very much there. There's no denying it. I have pictures printed off of it, but it was just incredible. And I think, you know, it's one of those things that, you know, for me, I was kind of like some of the other athletics competitors this time round who were kind of late to qualify, hadn't really been part of the whole Olympic buzz. And there definitely wasn't the same build up as there was for as this time round, with there's so much media days and team days and so much more about it. So I felt the opening ceremony was that first time that I really felt that I was part of something really, really big, that this wasn't a normal championships, you know, walking out into that stadium and 80,000 people screaming and shouting and walking around and seeing the sheer size of it. It was really spectacular. So the 28 people who do get to take part in the opening ceremony tomorrow are very, very lucky. It is a long day. It's a long evening. So it is something that people have to consider in terms of performance. But it is something that can be a bit of a once in a lifetime opportunity as well. But I would keep an eye out for different athletes' social medias, because I think there's different plans in the different holding camps for their own versions of opening ceremonies. So I'd be keeping an eye on how they're all planning to recreate it with those beautiful suits that they got fitted for, that won't ever get to see the light of day on the Seine.
Very good. We'll keep that in mind. Just looking at a more kind of overall theme, David, there's a little bit of a dark cloud, or quite a large dark cloud, in the kind of row brewing between USADA and WADA, alphabet soup there. But basically, the US anti-doping and US athletes, especially swimmers like Michael Phelps and Ledecky, are very unhappy about how WADA dealt with the Chinese doping cases of the swimmers pre-Tokyo Olympics that kind of came out a few months ago. And it's kind of turned into a war of words between USADA and WADA, and basically American anti-doping officials and American athletes concerned, taking it to Washington, saying that, you know, it's not a level playing field, when WADA are pretty happy to help, how they see it, help the Chinese anti-doping authorities sweep the doping or the failed tests of 23 swimmers under the carpet.
Yeah. Like, this has been rumbling on for a couple of years, because you might remember back in Tokyo, there were certain athletes basically wouldn't get on the podium with Chinese athletes who had won medals as a result of these adverse findings. Basically, they failed to open tests. And the reason they said it was because there was something found in the beef that they were eating. And I think the biggest bone of contention,
the hotel kitchen was completely contaminated. The air fans over the cooker and everything. It was TMZ everywhere.
So yeah, but and one of the kind of the fallout of this was then basically, why weren't the athletes given the ban, basically the 4-year ban, you know, as a result of the violation, which they weren't given. Then if it was a public health issue, well, then why wasn't there public health guidance released off the back of this? If it was a hotel kitchen, also the amount that was found in their blood, I think there was one doctor kind of pointed out they would have to eat an awful lot of beef, you know, and it just doesn't add up. So this has been rumbling on. WADA then have basically kind of come out, and they did a release there early July, and it always kind of, they're reviewing it at the moment, but they haven't brought in World Aquatics Anti-Doping Committee into the review, which is kind of a little bit strange when it was in the sport of swimming. So World Aquatics, why weren't they brought into the consultation and the review process? So these are the questions that I think people are asking, and not only the general public now as a result, but also a lot of other national kind of governing bodies, in terms of even Sport Ireland have kind of rode in behind USADA, and there's an awful lot now have come together and have released joint statements and asking these kind of questions, because there has to be a level of consistency. And that's the one thing that people are now questioning, is where is WADA's consistency in terms of, you know, these doping violations, which And like the harsh reality is, on the even Olympic Games, these are the things that, you know, certain athletes will start kind of reading about. And again, it goes back to that pot. It's another thing in the mix that suddenly there's this noise, particularly if you're a swimmer, you know, and we have swimmers, you know, that are heading into Paris. This is the moment of their careers. And then to have this kind of cloud kind of hanging around there. And let's be honest, like they do create the headlines. And I think, is it, how many is it of the 23? How many
13.
Are?
13.
Just 13, so it's quite a lot. Mm-hmm. Swimmers from China are going to be in the various events. And again, it's something that, you know, we're trying to manage this. We're trying to really clean up all sport. And WADA should be at the pointy end of this. And when there's a lack of consistency and there's no clear reasons as to why they haven't implemented the right bans, it just leaves a lot to question.
Yeah, and like when you hear, you know, the likes of Katie Ledecky and Michael Phelps, Jesse, kind of detailing how they could have been blood tested twice in the one day. That's kind of the commitment and they've given, and they just explain how they've completely given up their privacy, you know, so that they can compete at the highest level. And this is just what they had to do. And they accepted this probably in their teens. And, you know, there's Irish athletes probably, you know, in a, like, you know, having to give similar levels of commitment and, you know, and are quite open about it and, you know, get asked regularly about it, you know. Daniel Whiffen has had to answer questions repeatedly about, you know, kind of doping because of his, you know, because he's made such rapid improvements, and he's very open about it, and he talks about it, and he accepts that it's there. But his fallback is, I'm tested and I'm tested and I'm tested. So it's a difficult thing, but a sports psychologist like yourself would probably say this is an uncontrollable that your athletes can't control, and it's just something that they can't lose energy thinking about.
Yeah, look, you hit it on the head. One of the psychologist's mantra is control the controllables. And unfortunately, this is one of those massive uncontrollables. Just because it's not in your control, does it mean that people aren't giving their energy to it? No, I mean, it's very hard to ignore. I will admit, I've probably been a bit blinkered to the latest on it myself, because I have been focused on preparing people for performance. So you kind of realize how easy it is to blinker that stuff. But I'm also not a swimmer who's going to be competing against these athletes who, you know, by all means are have a completely unfair advantage potentially against these athletes, or who've just cheated the system in a way that they shouldn't, when we have athletes who, you know, like you said, Daniel Whiffen has repeatedly said he feels he's one of the most tested athletes in the country. He feels that he's, you know, why, you know, there's this feeling of it being really unfair, and it is, because why should some people be held to a different standard than others? But elite sport is inherently unfair. And this is just one of those huge areas where it still remains an issue. I don't know how it can be, you know, what the resolve will be, but it's nothing is going to change between now and Saturday when swimming kicks off. So it really is a case of how these athletes just focus on what they can do to swim their fastest swims and not think about who is in the lane beside them, whether it's a Chinese athlete or anyone else, because the more energy you give to somebody else in the pool, the less energy you have for you doing your own performance. So as hard as it is, and it's, you know, myself and David are both in athletics, which has had all its own controversies with doping, but you just have to park it, because there's always going to be something that could distract you from your performance and feel that that's taken away from your potential, but just can't give it the energy.
Yeah, I think it's one of those things that, like, you know, exactly, you can't give it the energy at the time, and it's probably something that might come to the forefront after the Olympics, you know, and then you kind of go, oh, well, so-and-so, you know.
What could have been?
And that's the hard thing to take post-Olympics. But yeah. I think, you know, athletics has had major issues, and, you know, I'm sure Jesse included, like, we've probably taken to the track at times, and there's been one or two that, you know, have, you know, certain, you know, issues around whereabouts and all that sort of stuff. But again, you got to put the blinkers on and focus on yourself. And probably in subsequent years, you look back and go, Jesus, you remember him? Well, he was.
Yeah.
But at that moment, you can't, because then the focus is off yourself, and you just got to focus on you.
Yeah. Absolutely. Okay, well, now before we finish up, let's focus on how many medals we're going to win, David. That's what everybody wants to know, because...
Right, are we going to see the fence here?
Glad you went to David first.
Because, you know, we're seeing... It seems that the pessimistic prediction is that we'll at least equal the record number of six we won in London, and then you're seeing people running off and saying double figures. So where'd you land on this yourself?
Yeah, it's interesting, you know, because again, a couple of weeks out, you're going, oh, this could be really good. And we could be hitting, you know, you go into the various databases and they spit out nine and all this. I don't know how they come up with it, but that's what they spit out. And then you go, God, you know what? If it really goes well, maybe we can get the double figures. And then you kind of get very close to it. And then it goes, well, maybe 4-7 or something like that. But I kind of crunched, I wouldn't say crunched the numbers, but I went in and I kind of, you know, had a little bit of time to myself today. And I actually kind of looked through, okay, well, like going by the various rankings and kind of, you know, various European champs and world champs that we have in the given events, I kind of went through and said, all right, well, like if everything goes really well, where would that land? And I came out with roughly about 10 medals. Okay. So and I'm talking medals here. I'm not really kind of talking on colors, but I think in athletics, probably kind of maybe one there. I think relays and Rashida having a role and everything at the moment can be quite tricky. So I'm kind of keeping it quite simple. So maybe one from athletics, one from gymnastics with Reese, maybe one in swimming, Daniel Whiffen again. I think the rugby sevens, obviously after
Yeah.
their game today,
Yeah,
it's
so
a
we're recording between their defeat to New Zealand and their glorious victory over Fiji in the quarterfinals. So we're not quite sure yet, but they've
Everything
made it
crossed.
they've made it tricky for themselves. Let's just put it that
They
way.
have, but like
Yeah.
this is the level that you're at, and like those fine margins. I think boxing again with 10 qualified are female boxers as well. I think we've got one of the biggest quotas from a European nation in terms of women qualified. So all going well, maybe three in that. Optimistic. Rowing again, good strength and depth. Maybe two medals coming out of rowing. And the show jumpers again are one that we kind of often forget about, but they're ranked number one in the world. So, all in all, that's probably coming in somewhere about kind of 10. So, like, everything has to go right for that to happen. And we're trying to get everything right within 2 weeks. And sport is sport. But, you know, when you look at the level that the individuals are competing at and the various teams, that if everything was to go right, maybe that's it. And that 10 would be fantastic. Absolutely.
You Sport Ireland Institute would take 10, I'd say, Jesse, would
Oh my God, we'd take 10 and run with it. Now, I say they would not be my medals.
they?
But yeah, look, I'm going to come from a very, very different. I'm going to be the typical sports psychologist, sit on the fence, stay in the gray area, and not commit to anything because, first of all, I don't want repercussions coming back on me as a sports psychologist who started making predictions, but also because I suppose the journey that I'm on with the athletes, I'm seeing, you know, we've spoken before about this idea again, Gavin Noble with his words of wisdom and like creating moments, and like the medals are one of those big moments, but other moments are going to be people who, you know, you look at someone like Nikita Tuttle in athletics who qualified as still as an under 23, and I think still has another year as an under 23 athlete is qualified through the ranking system. So for her to just be here and maybe throw a personal best and extend her under 23 record, that could be an amazing moment that might not get the same recognition because it won't probably be a medal. You know, we're going to get, I'd say if we were to look beyond the medals into the top fives and top tens, we're going to have, you know, looking at the standard of the athletes that we have and that like the kind of year we have that a lot of people are having coming into this games, we're going to have an awful lot of top tens. And I think that can, and I suppose what sparked that in my head was reading a piece about our history of athletes coming fourth at Olympics. We actually have quite a long history of it. Quite a few athletes have done it, my own brother Thomas included. And, you know, just how that being that close can just change your whole experience. So I'm always very conscious to kind of bring the broader conversation as well to the kind of the bigger moments as well. But I absolutely agree with David. I think 10 medals is completely possible based on like what we've, you know, what we've done. Am I going to say who's done them and how they're going to do it? No, but I think based on the caliber of athletes we're bringing and, you know, some people who I believe probably are real championship performers as well, I think we could have a really special games.
Okay, well, we take that absolutely.
Political answer, I know.
Yeah, no, we'll your answer was 10. I heard 10. That's all I heard. 10.
I
No,
disagreed.
yeah.
I agreed.
Well, look, here's one for you before we finish up. Well, we're here wondering how many medals we'll win, and don't really mind about the color. And you know, as you say, we're already praising the people who might do a PB or just like get that experience. Certain countries are keen on winning the first medal because, you know, it gets you top of the medal chart. And if you win as many medals as China, that's something you kind of think about. So here's a little fact for you. I'm going to try have a little fact every day that might be of some interest or no interest. But anyway, the first medal to be won on Saturday morning will be around 10 o'clock in the morning or a little bit after. And it will either be in the 3 meter springboard diving or the 10 meter air rifle mixed team. And just so happens that China are roaring favorites in both of those.
Worse.
Yeah, so I don't know whether they focus on these because it is, it's seemingly, I've read into it, it's a big thing in China. They want to win the first medal. Diving, as we know, they utterly dominate, and people may not be as focused on the shooting, but they're very, very good at shooting as well. So chances are, whichever one of those events crowns its gold medal winner first, there's a good chance they'll be Chinese. So that's just one to look out for on Saturday morning.
Well, hang on. I've got one. Okay, so well, it's 100 years since Ireland competed in the Olympic Games as a sovereign state, which happened to be Paris 100 years ago. We won a medal there. Can you? Well, our first medal as a sovereign state in the Olympic Games.
Was it Jack B. Yeats for painting?
Okay, yeah, good. Okay, but we actually won a second medal at those games.
Did we?
Yeah, I got to have my hands up. I didn't actually realize this. I knew the
I
Jack
didn't
B.
either.
Yeats Olympic
Yeah.
in painting, but we won another one.
Oh yeah.
You know?
Nope.
Not a clue.
Okay, well, it was Oliver Gogarty. It won a bronze in literature.
Really?
What?
Yeah.
When did these events go?
I know, yeah.
Land of saints
Are
and scholars.
they the 100 years ago equivalent of the esports that has been spoken about coming in and future games? Is that what
Yeah.
that's what that was?
Probably, you know.
Wow.
Yeah.
Well, so is that like English paper one in your leaving cert? You get given a topic and you sit down and you have to write an essay in like an hour and a half or whatever.
Well, there you go. So Oliver Gogarty, yeah. I think he has a pub in Temple Bar, does he?
He does, I think you're right.
Represented.
Okay. Thank you very much to David and Jesse. I will be back tomorrow evening, or Saturday morning, depending on how you digest this. Please do follow us on wherever you get your podcasts or on YouTube. And of course, RTE is the place to follow these Olympics, Paris 2024 on RTE 2 and the RTE player, all day and all night, basically. And the RTE website and the RTE News app with our live blogs, exclusive highlights, is your perfect digital accompaniment, and there'll be extensive coverage on RT Radio as well. So we will have you covered for these games. The sun is coming out now as we finish recording, so that's a good sign, I think. Thank you to David and to Jesse, and I will chat to you tomorrow. Good luck. Goodbye.